This is the Amp Hour Podcast, recorded September 8th, 2013, episode 162, Astrobogulus, Openness, Occasion. Welcome to the Amp Hour. I'm Chris Gamble of ContextualElectronics.com.
And this is Jeff Kaiser of MightyOhm.com.
Making his glorious return.
Yeah, it's great to be back. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Jeff. It's been a while, man.
I know. I looked it up today.
On the show.
It has been a while. You guys are very prolific. There have been, I think, 47 episodes since the last time I was on the show, which was almost exactly 1 year ago this month. So. Yeah. Amazing. Yeah. Time flies.
It does fly. It would be even more, but we did end up skipping two shows during winter last year, during the holidays, which we might make a tradition. You know, nothing happens during the holidays.
Well, you get to take some time off and you give people a chance to catch up, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And it's not so bad.
Plus this year I'll be running around like with a chicken with my head cut off, you know?
Why is that?
That'll be right in the middle of Contextual Electronics.
I see.
So, we'll see. But you and I, it's not like we haven't seen each other. We were just hanging out, like, what, 24 hours ago? A little more?
A little more than that. But yeah, we were just in Boston together for the Open Hardware Summit.
Yeah, it was good to see you, man. It was, it's been a while.
Yeah, because you weren't at the Maker Faire Bay Area, right? Mm-hmm. So that means it's been quite a while. I can't remember the last time, maybe Maker Faire New York or something like that. No,
probably Maker Faire before that even. Probably.
Oh, so yeah, 2 years
20,
ago,
2012 or whatever.
Crazy. Yeah, that has been a long time. But yeah, it was great to be in the same city and catch up. And it was a really quick trip for me. I was only out in Boston for a couple days, but it was awesome. I had a really great time.
Yeah, you said it had been a while since you'd been out there, right?
Yeah, I can't remember the last time I'd been in Boston, but it's probably been at least 6 or 7 years. So it was long enough that when I got there, I was completely lost and had to had to like crawl around, figure out on maps where to go. And the thing that was interesting to me is that last time I spent the bulk of my time in Boston itself, like city center, and this time pretty much didn't leave Cambridge, and so it was like a completely new experience and really
different city.
Really cool. Yeah. Cambridge is awesome. I was really impressed. And I spent, so the Open Hardware Summit, for folks that weren't there or didn't know, was on Friday, and it was only a 1 day thing. So this year they held it separately from the Maker Faire. So Open Hardware Summit in Boston, 1 day, MIT,
no holds barred.
No holds barred. Yeah. At
20 men enter, one man leaves, you know. And
well,
women
so,
too. Sorry.
So in previous years, the Open Hardware Summit has been held jointly. I don't think there was any actual connection, but it was done on the same weekend as the New York Maker Faire. And this year was the first year that they were separate. Mm-hmm. And I honestly was trying to make up my mind, you know, which one do I go to? And I decided that the summit was more interesting to me. And apparently over 500 other people did too, or at least 500 people are going to go to both, because it was totally sold out and packed. Like, it was amazing. I felt like I got to see people that I hadn't seen in a long time from all parts of the country. So that was really cool.
Yeah, it was nice. I mean, I talked to a lot of people beforehand too, you know, asking, and there was that decision point a lot of people made. So it did seem like there was a lot that weren't there that might have been in the past. And you know, you could see it in the speaker list too. You know, there's usually like the usual suspects, and a lot of them weren't there. And so that kind of showed it just from the top level. But at the same time, as I told someone while I was there, it's nice because then you meet new people. I was saying like, oh, well, it's disappointing that a lot of people won't be there that I know, but then it's like, but that means that I'll meet even more people, right? I mean, like, that's kind of the benefit of having a conference that's different at that point.
Yeah, I totally agree. I met a bunch of people that I had never met in person before, like Ryan O'Hara of O'Hara RP. That I also learned how to pronounce his company name. I met the speaking of guys that are kind of in the stencil business, the guy from OSH Stencils was there too. A bunch of people. It was great. I think this year there were more familiar faces than the last time I was there, which was 2 years ago. It kind of felt like it was a who's who of people in the open hardware community, but you're right in that it felt kind of different and new because it was in a different location. And there were also a few folks, and I think students too, from MIT, which was really cool to see as well.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, like, and it's cool that it moved to a new location too, like for just kind of the surrounding stuff, right? I mean, like the Hall of Science is interesting, but I mean, MIT's campus is gorgeous and surrounding areas, like you mentioned. So
it's like a geek mecca. It's I actually spent, so the summit was on Friday, and I spent most of Saturday, which is yesterday for us recording now, just kind of wandering around campus. And it is a gorgeous campus, and it's so interesting to someone who kind of appreciates electronics and technology, because you walk around and you see these labs, and it's like you recognize the equipment that's in the labs. You can kind of figure out, oh yeah, you know, that's what these guys are doing. Or it's a beautiful campus. By the way, MIT has an amateur radio station, which I didn't get to see the inside of. I was kind of bummed, but I did get to see the outside. They have probably the most impressive looking antenna array of any amateur radio station on a college campus that I've ever seen by far. Like, it is crazy. And I think it's building 50 is where the Ham Shack is. And they've got this antenna that just looks bigger than the building. It's really amazing.
Oh, wow.
So hopefully, if anybody's in the Ham Radio Club at MIT, next time I'm there, I would totally want a tour. I want to see the inside of that thing, because it must be amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. And did you get up to Harvard at all either?
No, I didn't. So I stuck around MIT and was actually hoping to get up to Harvard, but just ran out of time. It was such a short trip for me and a short weekend. And I was actually remarking to somebody I was talking to over the weekend that I think the summit totally could have been like a 2-day thing. It felt really short because it was a single day, and because there wasn't another event that weekend, it almost felt like, man, I've come all this way, and then there's just this one day of activity, and then that's it, and everyone, you know, disperses. And I think if I was in the organizing committee, I know it's a huge amount of work to organize an event like that, but I think making it a 2-day event would give it a lot more substance, and it would also give people a little bit of a chance to kind of settle in and get kind of comfortable with the venue and being around, you know, all these amazing people. I think it would just make it a much more memorable experience. But that said, it was still totally awesome. I had a really great time.
Yeah. I talked to Jimmy Rogers about it after the event on Friday? Yeah, it was Friday. so we were hanging around afterwards, and I think you had left at that point, but Jimmy mentioned that they were talking about making it more than one day next year. And so I'm sure it'll sell out even faster, and maybe the venue could have handled another probably 600 or 700 people, at least in the seating area. You know, that it's in this really cool auditorium. There's pictures all over. There's a picture on the front page of the Open Hardware Summit page that it's just like this. I don't know if it's like an eighth of a dome or a quarter dome, but it's like this weird metal sphere part.
And then it kind of looks like it's like insectoid. It's like it's very
like a beetle
insect looking thing. And it's what is it, Kresge or Kresge Auditorium?
Kresge.
It was kind of funny because most of the summit was in this beautiful, amazing auditorium, and then in between sessions there were posters and demos set up in this narrow little hallway that goes around the outside
with 500 people in it.
So a couple times a day we got to experience having 500 people crammed into this tiny little hallway, and I mean it was fun, but I did what I always do at conferences like this, and I skipped a few of the talks so that I could actually wander around and talk to people and take a look at the demos. And I think that was the way to do it, was to just kind of get out of phase with the rest of the attendees.
Yeah,
it was great.
I agree. And like you said, when you were doing it, I was like, Jeff, why aren't you in the session? Because I was chugging coffee like a crazy person, because I haven't sat in a dark lecture hall for God knows how long, and my brain yeah. doesn't like it. But you mentioned yeah. too, you said, you know, all of these are going to be recorded, they're all going to be released, so it makes sense to kind of do that kind of thing. And I agree that the people are the reason to be there in the first place.
Yeah.
But yeah, so people listening, you can, I'm not sure when they're going to actually be posted, but they will be posted eventually if you're interested in the talks. And then, you know, you can see all, and there's the schedule's already up, of course, but the actual videos will be up soon too.
And speaking of people, the Amp Hour meetup, huge success.
Huge success, yes.
Huge success.
Yeah.
That was epic. Epic way to start the event. It was just, yeah, awesome experience. Tons of awesome, wonderful, interesting, amazing people. And for whatever reason, the venue decided that there shouldn't be chairs for us, but it totally didn't matter because I stood and talked to people for, it must have been like 3 or 4 hours.
Yeah.
It was,
yeah,
it was
great. We were at a place called the Mead Hall, which is like, which unfortunately it had like 100 taps there, like beer taps and stuff. And we were upstairs like sequestered away from them, but it didn't even matter, like you said, because we were just talking
no.
to people. But I'd put an estimate at like 50 or 60 people probably coming through for the whole party. I mean, it seemed like it was, because a lot of people brought others, you know, and they, you know, it ended up just kind of being a gathering place, which is what I wanted in the first place. So it was great, and I really do appreciate the Mead Hall being there. It's a cool space. I recommend it. Before that, we got to go tour Bolt as well, which is the new hardware accelerator place in Boston proper, and that was really cool too. It was it was kind of like a really well-funded hackerspace or makerspace. That's kind of how I heard people talking about it, and I agree with that.
Yeah, it seemed like it. And one of the things I thought was most interesting about Bolt is, and I think hackerspaces should totally consider this idea, Bolt is a hardware accelerator, and so they have this program where startups can spend, I think it's 6 months at the Bolt headquarters or facility, space, whatever, working on their startup idea. And in that 6 months, Bolt actually has a mechanical engineer, industrial designer, and electrical engineer on staff to
yeah.
help these companies, because they're all kind of, they have this great idea, but they may not necessarily have one or more of those skills as part of their, you know, it's usually one or two people are trying to start this company. And that to me just seemed like a really interesting way to do this. And I think it works for both parties, right? It helps Bolt ensure that these companies are successful, because Bolt obviously gets equity in
yep.
these startups, and so it's in their best interest to make sure they make it. And it's also great for the startups too, who may not, you know, necessarily have all the skills or resources to get those kinds of things. So I was kind of fascinated by that. A really interesting visit.
I'm usually a little bit touchy on the, you know, the equity, you know, what you actually get for that. And that's sort of usually the complaint I hear as well. It's like 8% usually. That's like pretty standard for like accelerators, like 8 to 10%, depending on how much money they actually give you. That can be dicey, you know, and they always say, oh, there's mentoring.
Right.
But yeah, like you right. said, you know, having engineers on staff is, that's killer. And the space is really nice too. It's really nicely equipped. And you don't see that, you know, with most accelerators are software, so it's usually, you know, cubes and, you know, well-stocked food room and everything like that. But this is like shop floor and like a InfiniVision, or what was the 4000 series scope that
yeah,
they got.
Had a couple Agilent 3000 and 4000 series
yeah.
scopes and a bunch of milling machines, and they had a couple 3D printers and the biggest Epilogue laser cutter I've ever seen in person before, a huge Epilogue.
Yeah.
The one thing they didn't have was a PCB mill, which I was a little bit surprised by, but they had kind of all the other basic things that you might expect to find in a space. And it actually kind of reminded me a little bit of the Valve workshop as well, because we have a lot of the same equipment. So it looked like they had a lot of the ingredients that you would need to start a hardware company, especially something that's based on either machined parts or electronics. It was really cool to see. I was really impressed.
Yeah. Yeah. And the nice thing too is that we kind of came in at 5. It was nice of Chris and Ben to set up the tour for us there. But they, you know, there's a lot of companies that are still working and, like, you know, actually just kind of like sitting around and answering questions for us and everything. And that was great too, because you could ask them about what they're working on and, you know, where they've been and everything. And that's, that's like the best part of a tour, right? I mean, it's, you know, the equipment's interesting, but it's the people using the equipment that's also usually more interesting, and hearing about how it's going.
Yeah, I agree.
So yeah, it was a whirlwind tour. You missed, you went home early, unfortunately, after the summit, but we ended up walking from MIT out to Somerville. And I know, we walked to Artisan's Asylum, and that was a long walk. It was about a 35-40 minute walk, which at the end of the day, you know, after standing up all day, I'll say I was complaining a little bit. It was I'm sorry to everyone I was complaining to.
You know that Boston has a great public transportation system,
it
right?
does. It does, but yeah. not to Somerville. So basically Artisans is like in this weird area. And I was talking, so Jimmy Rogers was the one showing us around, because he's one of the main members there. And on the way out there, he actually said a lot of people are, it's getting real gentrified in Somerville because there's not a red line going through there. So it's like there's some kind of weird hipster thing going on out there. But anyways, the space is gorgeous. I mean, it's 40,000 square feet, and it makes Bolt look like, you know, someone's garage with the amount of equipment they have there. I'm not sure about the advanced nature of the equipment in terms of, like, you know, especially like the electrical side of things. Their electrical shop's not as good, and their CNCs aren't quite as good. But because they have so much floor space, you know, they've got like 3 or 4 CNC'd bridge ports. They have, they have an entire wood shop, and this is all like separate areas. I mean, the wood shop alone is probably a good 5,000 square feet. And then there's a whole welding area. There's a whole machining area. I got to see Stompy, my foster child. do you know what Stompy is?
No.
It was a Kickstarter project that Artisans put on. It was a walking rideable robot. So 18 foot wide. Two people can ride it in the seat and actually drive this hexapod robot around. It's
wow.
It's kind of insane, but I didn't back it very much. I backed it because the bumper sticker says, "My other car has 6 legs."
cool.
So that's now on my car, and so I get to finally see it in person. Though, I mean, I've seen the updates and everything from Kickstarter, but I mean, like, these guys are welding like maniacs. I mean, this stuff is like water jet cut steel, and you know, there's I forget what kind of engines in there. I have pictures I can post. Some kind of intensely... Oh, it was a forklift engine they're actually using, like some diesel forklift engine to power the thing. And so, like, some of the Kickstarter backers will actually be riding in it. I mean, it's, like, insane.
Wow.
So, yeah. And then, you know, they have all the usual stuff. But then the really cool thing about that space is that the majority of the space there is actually, like, rented out cubicles. And when I say cubicle, I mean, like, a 50-square-foot area that you know, local artists and, you know, tech people can rent and use. And so there's like bike shops in there and jewelers and like, you know, like usual artisanal type stuff in there. But I mean, like, it's just really nice in there. It's just I was very, very impressed. Jimmy said that they have operating costs of like over $80,000 a month or something like that. Like some
whoa.
Like, but like they're making rent and everything. I mean, like they're it seems like they're doing really well. And I highly recommend people go stop by there when they get a chance. It's a really neat space.
Oh, very cool. Did you have a chance to see the MIT Museum while you were there?
I did not. I saw some people talking about it on Twitter after I left. I left Saturday morning, unfortunately, so I didn't get to hang out with Jeff that day.
I was, so Saturday, JJ Walrus from Twitter and I took a look, wandered down to the museum. It was really close to the Meridian Hotel.
Yeah,
and it was really cool. Actually, I had been there a few years ago, but most of the exhibits had changed, and it was kind of cool. There was a Makey Makey on display, and I hadn't thought of that, but I guess that project has an association with MIT. I think one of the guys behind it is from MIT.
Oh, cool!
And they also had a really cool robotics exhibit that I think is a little bit older, but was still super interesting to take a look at, not necessarily because of the robots, which were really cool, but because each of these robots was from a very different time period, and it spanned all the way from maybe the 80s to the mid-2000s.
Mm-hmm.
And so by looking at these robots, you could see, not only were these really interesting because of the research that they were doing, that the, you know, professor or grad student or whatever was using them for, but it also gave you this survey of like electronics prototyping and construction techniques over the past 20 or 30 years.
Yeah.
It was
like
kind
wire
of a trip.
Wrap and everything.
No, totally. So like wire wrap and funky sockets that have IDC on the back of the socket, so you can use like magnet wire to connect sockets, and and like a lot of proto board and point to point wiring. And then, you know, you get into the mid 2000s and then people are starting to actually use printed circuit boards.
Yeah.
It was just really interesting, and I kept thinking, you know, man, today we are so lazy. There is no way that I would do a point to point wired board, because some of these were really, really complicated. You know, now I would just use Osh Park or something like that to make a
Well, don't you have an LPKF too? I mean, you have like have fancy stuff, but
we've got one at the office. But I mean, even if you don't, prototype PCBs are so fast and so cheap these days, there's no way that doing a wire wrap board would ever make sense, especially for some of these robots that were kind of symmetric and had lots of the same circuits over and over. I really felt for the grad students that were stuck wire wrapping all this stuff together.
Yeah.
Just amazing. So I thought that was really interesting.
I had a coworker come up to me as a technician at work. He comes up to me the other day, and he had been like going through some storage area stuff. He comes up to me, hands me a tool, and it looks like, you know, like the base of a screwdriver, just like a metal screwdriver. And on the end, it's like, it got this weird head on it with like a little keyhole on it. And he's like, you know what that is? And I'm like, dude, I'm sorry. I have no idea what I'm looking at right now. He's like, that's a wire wrap tool.
Yeah.
And he's like, you know how that works? I'm like, yeah, I know how that works. He's like, don't you wish you could have done that? I'm like, no, I don't wish I could have done that. That sounds terrible.
it does sound terrible. It sounds maddening.
Oh God. Yeah. I never thought about it that with the replicating type of stuff too. That's a really good point, because I'm, you know, like one time probably wouldn't be too bad, but you know, four times or six times, you know, and then just having variability between the boards has got to be killer for doing the wire wrap stuff.
Yep.
But
it's really cool though to see that these research projects are sort of like a time capsule, and it's really cool to look at the 70s and 80s stuff and go, oh yeah, you know, I guess those components were common during that time frame. And then you look at the later stuff and you can kind of see how just everything changes, like the way that you do trim pots and connectors and everything is just totally different. Like the techniques are different and the components are different. And I mean, these guys are just using whatever is readily available or surplus or cheap. And so it's kind of, they're following the, you know, forward progress of technology, especially electronics and surface mount.
Yeah. That's funny, because I think about like, some of the cheap stuff. I was just talking to Jeff about an ATX power supply and how, you know, it's so cheap, I'm going to probably use it in a project coming up. And it's like, the same kind of thing, right? That's like readily available. They're junk. They're easy to get to. And it's like, you just use it, you throw in a project and you're done. You just move on. So there must've been stuff like that.
In 30 years, there's probably, that's going to be different, right?
Of course, it's,
yeah.
It'll be some like 30 megahertz switcher or something like that will be totally commonplace. And
it'll be the size of a 9-volt battery.
yeah. Well, that's cool, man. I'm sorry I didn't get to go see that. But, you know, there's always next time. And
yeah, I hope they have the summit at MIT again next year.
I heard rumor that next year might be out west, actually.
Whoa.
Which would be...
That would rock my world. That would mean that I don't have to travel really far to go there.
Oh yeah,
that would be amazing.
Yeah, that would be different for me as well. But no, it's good to move around.
You get to finally taste some of you guys in your East Coast events making all of our sweaters.
Oh yeah, there's nothing out there on the West, right? Definitely not Design West or Make a Fair.
That's true.
Or, you know,
that's true. Well, that'd be really interesting. I can think of lots of places that would be great to have the summit on the West Coast. So,
yeah, definitely
cool.
And people should sign up early next year, because I bet we're gonna have some one-upitude in the badge and or goodie bag department, which this year was pretty one-upitude to start with.
It sure was. Yeah.
I'd like to first call out the Spark Fun shovel. This is I'm opening it right now. This thing is insane. It's a titanium spork. It's like a spork. What is it? It's the shovel is an acronym for semi-horned
oblong, versatile eating ladle. Shovel.
So yeah. Weird. And apparently it's open source too, but I haven't tried to download the plans.
I'm sure that getting one fabricated would be the main barrier to entry. It's not like you got a lot of titanium machinists around.
How
do you even do this? It doesn't look like it's machined at all.
I don't think you can machine titanium easily.
I know you can. I've looked at it before, but yeah.
I think that the shovel may not warrant the same types of machining techniques that, you know, aerospace uses.
right. But yeah, there was a lot more PCBs this year. There was some cool kit, like Little Bits. The kit maker had actually a pretty decent sized kit in there as well. I mean,
I was impressed. I was really surprised. Definitely, the last time I was at the summit was 2 years ago, and this goodie bag was just much heavier. Like, I was actually very nervous taking it through the airport this year because there was so much electronics in there, but I made it through just fine. It was awesome. Hey, what did you think about the summit being at an academic institution this year? That actually kind of made me ponder a little bit about kind of how openness fits into traditional academic research
and like how journals are super closed
and how typically
expensive.
It's not open. So it was kind of interesting to me, this dichotomy between this very open event where people are preaching, publish your work, use open source tools, share everything, and then you've got this against the backdrop of an academic institution, which I think is awesome. I have a lot of respect for MIT and the people that are doing research there. But, I mean, this is not a place where this is a very traditional institution where, to my knowledge, most research is published in traditional journals, which are, of course, not open.
Yeah.
I thought was interesting.
There was a talk about it. Maybe you weren't. I think it's Paulo. Maybe it was someone else. But basically, they were talking about that as well, because I think it might also been, it came up more than once, the Dropbot as well, which was an awesome, awesome product, or project rather.
Right.
But yeah, they did talk about that, you know, like the fact that journals aren't open, and it might have also been Matthew Borgatti. He talks about how open is your source, you know, the fact that people don't publish, you know, documentation sometimes as well, like that kind of idea. So
yeah,
it definitely
was
interesting. An underlying kind of thing. I was kind of struck by, it seemed like I've only been one other time as well. It was actually the first one I went to. I was struck by it seemed like a lot of people brought a lot of different things into it. You know, like the openings talk was really, really, was really political. And there was other stuff about, like, you know, and then it jumps into like profit motives for other things as well. Like, and so it was weird. It's like, it seemed like everyone was coalesced around open source, but at the same time, there was a lot of different,
It was like they were
frames.
There for different reasons. Like people
exactly.
Different reasons to be open and different things that they're expecting to get as a result of being open.
Exactly.
I thought that was interesting too.
Yeah, and it's at the base of it, it doesn't matter, right? I mean, it's good that people are talking about it regardless. But right. I think it's probably going to create conflict eventually, right? I mean, because same kind of thing happened with the free software movement, right? And the first speaker was Evan Moglen. He was part of that, and that's why they asked him to speak. Mm-hmm. But you know, like Richard Stallman and Evan, and they're very, very principled and very staunch in their views, and it's like, you know, it's like kind of like shades of gray, because then also we're talking about people starting businesses out of this and stuff too, right? And I heard someone tell me a story about meeting Richard Stallman and mentioning open source, and he just kept shouting free software and free hardware. How does that work? I don't understand.
To mention that some of the projects, I think even the ones that were discussed on Friday, are DARPA funded as well. So there's this
There's always
government
this
connection. It's interesting. I think I think you're right that there is bound to be conflict, but hopefully it's conflict that's helpful for the community and just good to be talking about these things in public and with a wide audience.
I was curious. Gonna say, as long as people are civil and hopefully drinking beer at some point and, you know, licking their wounds and you know, making friends,
that's right.
Still, that's all that really matters, right? I mean, that's as long as you can stay civil and then friendly, it's that'll have the biggest net effect, I think, over time. Did you see any awesome PCBs?
I did.
You better have. Well,
are you God looking for?
I'm looking for a pat on the back, Jeff.
I was really. Now I have to say that I didn't get to see it until I got home because I pretty much just took the goodie bag, slapped it in my suitcase, and then brought everything home, dumped it out on the mattress. You know, like taking a look at everything.
It's like Halloween.
It was totally like Halloween. But I didn't steal anybody else's.
Goodies. Right.
Right. Like usual, but the amp hour PCBs, totally badass. I was really impressed. The silk screen and solder mask openings and the gold finish, really cool, really well done. So,
well, thank you. Good job, Chris. I didn't expect this kind words, Jeffrey. No, the interesting thing about this is, so there's two things. One, the first time I saw the board in real life was at the when I opened my bag. That was definitely scary.
I can imagine.
Yeah, so Lane helped me out with this as well. He also helped sponsor it a little bit, the board at least. It was really nice of Lane to give me a lot of help, and we all know how awesome he is. It was just getting under the wire, and so I just wasn't going to see it, which is a terrible idea. I mean, I should just state that up front. Especially because Lane had sent... Well, I sent Lane a PCB... the Gerbers rather with the milling directions. How do you do milling directions when you send out PCBs?
Milling directions?
Yeah, so like if you're doing like routes and stuff like that, like actual cutouts.
Oh, usually just put it on a mechanical layer.
Yeah, but do you do it as like do you actually trace out the outline of like the space? So if it's like if you want a single path cut, right, and it's maybe 100 or 200 mils wide, do you actually trace the outside of the path, or do you set the path to be a certain width?
It sort of depends, and I'm probably not as consistent as I should be, but usually it's whatever the fab house wants, and every fab house is different. And we were talking about this before the show, too. Like, fab houses, they always... muck with your data and they always
sometimes
have
for good.
Sometimes for good, sometimes not for good. And I think in my experience, I've typically used like the inside dimension as the routing line and said somewhere in the fab notes or in, you know, an email to route to the dimensions as shown in the mechanical layer. But I haven't done really complicated panelized boards like what this board is that I'm holding in my hand. That is a complicated bunch of routing. Although I suspect that Lane would have some unique experience.
Well, that's how I got started. Like, I actually just asked him for some help, like looking at my Gerbers, and then he like started launching into like actually helping with the boards as well. And I'm like, oh, awesome. So, but yeah, this is the first time I actually, so in KiCad, you can actually set the width of the line. So like if you're drawing the line, I'm not sure in like Eagle, I did never do any big routes in Eagle, but if you, I saw this on someone who was panelizing, they did these wide cutout lines, and I'm like, wow, like that is so much easier. Because otherwise you think every time, you know, if you have a space that you're cutting out, right, maybe like 100 mils wide and then like 1,000 mils long, right, and that's like a big gap you want, like you have to actually trace around that, and you're making like a square, and it's like every time you change anything, then it gets really tough. Whereas if you're just drawing a single line that's 100 mils wide, then you not only get the rounded edges, which is good for like a milling machine like they use, but then you also get then it's a way easier to draw it as well, and then it's still center line. You can actually track.
I think that's really inconsistent between CAD tools, and that's one of those things that just kind of falls a little outside the boresight of what 99% of users are doing. I think Altium does it differently than how KiCad would do that, but obviously it all worked out in the end because the boards look great. I mean,
you know, I just realized I didn't put an open source hardware logo on this. I should release these files, and that was really dumb of me. So I'll do that if people want to see them. I'll put a note in to actually release these files. But it was crazy. And so the only thing that was bad, and this is something I'll be talking about in the course later when I actually start making the video about this specific thing, my tolerance around all the pads for the solder mask actually wasn't set properly. And so if you look closely at the solder mask, there's actually no solder mask between, at least on my boards, there was no solder mask between the pins for the QFN and the
That's actually pretty
the flat
common.
Pack.
That's pretty common.
Yeah, but it's terrible if you're you know, if you're doing solder paste type stuff.
You know, I found that it doesn't really matter that much. So the reason that that's common is because a lot of, especially low-cost fabs, fab houses, will have a pretty big solder mask sliver rule, minimum design rule, and almost all QFNs will fall below that. And the issue is that if they try to do it anyway, like if you tell them there must be solder mask there, it'll chip off. Yeah. And some board houses will change it without even telling you, which is back to what I was saying. Like that's kind of evil, and I find that unsettling. I mean, it's okay if they're right, but a lot of times they're not.
Right.
But some fab houses will just say, "Oh yeah, you know, whatever you were saying,
we changed it." Yeah. Right. And so that is what happened.
Yeah,
they changed
change
it
in
this case, but it was for the better actually. Because so I open up my bag, I was flipping out. I was like flipping out. Because, you know, like, this is the first time I saw it, and the solder mask didn't look very good to me. And then I looked at someone else's, and it was...
I think you need to relax.
Of course I do, Jeff. Come on, man. Have you listened to this show ever? but, yeah, then I looked at someone else's board, and it looks like they fixed it for me. Either Lane did, I haven't heard back from Lane yet, or the board house did, so...
My board looks really nice. I think they must have fixed it mid-run. They probably did a panel and then said, oh, no.
Yeah, and it was just pure luck that I got one that was not. So, it worked out okay.
So you did these in KiCad, right?
Yeah, KiCad.
You know, one of the interesting things about the Summit, and this is something I'm seeing more and more, I saw a couple examples of really, really impressive boards done using common open source, well, the tools themselves are not necessarily open source, but hobbyist level tools. Like, for example, the Parallel Computing guys were doing a board that had at least two or three BGAs on it, and they were using Eagle, and it was like a very dense board.
Yep.
And I've used Eagle to try to do four layer stuff, and it works all right, but it's kind of the hard way to do it. And I was just listening to the show with Michael Osman, and he's using KiCad to do like USB 3 stuff and just high density. That blows me away. I mean,
I know.
I've pretty much converted to Altium Designer over the past year, and I can't imagine going back. And I understand what people say about try to use accessible open source tools, but come on, like there's got to be a limit.
Well, yeah, and it's a question of that line, right? That's what I expected too. I honestly expect that with KiCad to run into something and be like, "Well, shit. I mean, I just can't. I can't do it." Right? I mean, sorry for swearing. But yeah, you know, like just something like I don't know, like BGA stuff. You know, stuff where very few people are doing it, so there's no focus on it in development. And you know, there's something weird. Just something weird happens.
It's not just that. It's time. And tools will save you time. And in that time, you can be doing design or you can be doing other products. And if you spend too much time trying to compensate for the inadequacies of a CAD tool, in my opinion, I mean, there is a trade-off with openness, but I think very quickly, I guess I have a very short attention span. It would be very hard to convince me to stop using Altium and to start using Eagle or learn a new tool like KiCad, because I've just found Altium to be so much more powerful of a tool. And I mean, if you look at people like Bunny, who are doing really impressive open hardware designs, he's using Altium, and I think he gets relatively little crap for using a, you know, somewhat expensive proprietary tool. So I think you have to pick your battles. Like you can't
definitely. And you know, that's one that I've actually come to peace with, because you know, it's actually not it's the relearning section of it, right? It's like
right.
You know, I don't wish that on anyone, because I've had to do that two or three times now, you know, and it's like learning new CAD tools is hard. So all I say is I advocate it at the beginning, and whenever you're making a big life change, like say you're leaving your, you know, a job where you're using Altium and you can't afford a license, I'd say, go learn KiCad, you know, take a month or two and learn it and you'll get into it, right? But if you're already in a workflow, it's like there's no reason for you to stop everything you're doing, you know, unless you have a very strong feeling about being able to share your files, in which case then you should, you know, then you should try and make provisions for it. So I've come to peace with that personally. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of people haven't still, so what are you gonna do? What are the things about Altium that you like the Is it like for like matched impedance type stuff or what kind of stuff?
No, it's actually the things that I think for me have been big life-changing aspects of the tool are that in Altium, and I actually don't know if KiCad's like this, so you'll have to tell me. In Altium, when you define a library component, you know, you've got your pads, right? You've got your footprint for the component. Now, if you place an instance of that component on a board, you can actually go in, say you place 10 of these components, you can actually edit the pads of each individual component as needed without having to edit the library component. And in one case, this is like super dangerous and super scary because you can lose the association between the footprint that you've got in your library, which is maybe known good, and what you actually spit out on the board. But it's also super awesome, especially for doing rapid prototyping, because if you decide, oh, you know, I'm just going to try to fudge this component in there, and I've got this footprint that's kind of close, I can just increase the size of a hole or make a pad bigger without having to edit the library. And that's pretty huge. Altium allows you to do a lot of sort of shortcutty stuff like that that just makes it way faster than Eagle, which is the other tool I've got a lot of experience with.
Yeah, well, if you knew KiCad, you'd know that that's pretty much possible in KiCad, too. Sorry, buddy.
So,
you okay, have. Okay, I was okay, watching Indiana Jones over the weekend again, and you have chosen poorly.
So then the other thing that I think is really big about Altium is the 3D stuff, which I was a total skeptic about for the first 3 months I used the tool. And then somebody showed me how easy it is to put step files in your components so that when you make a board, you've got all your connectors and everything all there in 3D. Super awesome, super easy, and you don't have to use a third-party tool. It's just right in the tool. So I've actually... Wait. Don't tell me KiCad has that feature, too.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, buddy.
Damn it!
No. I mean, it's a third-party tool, but it's totally integrated. It's called Windows 3D.
No. It's but can you switch between 2 and 3D with just a single key press?
It might be 2 key presses. I haven't used it much yet. Honestly, I haven't found the point where I need it, but yeah, especially if you're using like Circuit Hub or something like that, where they automatically associate 3D models with it, with the footprints. Yeah, sorry, man.
I'm way more impressed by KiCad now than I was 5 minutes ago.
If only you had a course where you could learn it quickly. Oh, that was shill. That was a shill.
But who would teach it to me?
I know.
I think CAD tool wars are so fun, and I'm not like religiously attached to any of these. I just, you know, I have the tool that works for me, and I've switched a couple times in the past, and I actually believe the same thing for CAD tools as I do for operating systems, and that you can't just learn one.
But there
always is going to be one that you're kind of best at, right? You've got your preferred weapon.
Right, and then you have a virtual machine running, and you switch to that when you're screwed, right?
Yeah, it's like SolidWorks versus the 10 other mechanical CAD. At work, we've got this battle between SolidWorks and PTC Creo Direct.
Yeah, that's
another
like
religious war. But yeah. I mean, everybody's the truth is that if you have the access to them, everyone will use both. Like it's almost impossible to just use one.
Right.
So when it comes to CAD tools, the right solution is just to have all. But you know, the learning curve is a big deal.
Right.
So anyway.
No, I totally agree. If you have the resources for it, that is the best solution.
Well, when they're free.
yeah. I should also mention, this is the first time I've seen Mr. Aussie Man's Bendy Ruler. He put one of those in the... He sponsored the summit as well.
I actually totally forgot about that, because I backed his possible, whatever it was, campaign. I remember originally he had said that he was making some for the Open Hardware Summit, and it's pretty cool. You know, I have to say, it's smaller than I expected it to be. I don't know what I had in my mind. I think I was thinking of, you know, here in the United States with our imperial units, rulers are typically 12 inches long.
Right.
I guess the Australian ruler, well, it is a micro ruler after all. But still, super, super cool, and I definitely am going to keep that near my desk, along with the Octopart business card that just came out last week.
Oh, yeah.
It was another
campaign. Yeah, we talked about that last week, actually.
That was cool.
2 weeks ago. 2 weeks ago, yeah.
I'm totally addicted to these things.
Oh, yeah, the reference PCBs and everything.
I've got the SparkFun one with the silkscreen text height and line width. That's a super handy one.
Oh, I haven't seen that one.
Yeah, that's an old one. It shows you silkscreen at, you know, 30, 40, 50 mils and different line weights. It's got the Eagle units, but it's still kind of handy to see how, like, bold different thicknesses of silkscreen are.
So that's really
nice. Pretty cool. Yeah, because that stuff is kind of hard to visualize, especially if you don't have 3D built into your
tool. Sorry, Eagle. Yeah. That's what we should do. We should just disparage Eagle some more, right?
I used to like Eagle quite a lot, but I am having a hard time using it now just because
I just downloaded it today again. I just I downloaded the I was looking at some Adafruit open files, and I was like, oh, I have no way to look. I don't think there's actually any board file level converters for that kind of thing, and so I'll download. I don't care, freemium version, whatever. And they've integrated some other stuff in there too, like the board ordering from there and the part ordering right from the tool, which is like makes sense from Element 14 buying CAD soft or whatever.
Yeah,
so ever so many years ago.
yeah, it took a while, but it is in there now. Yeah,
yeah, definitely.
I'm still on 5.11, so I don't get to play with those new features.
Right. Then and that doesn't have the. XML files, which is too bad.
Yeah, it's true.
I've been having a little man crush on GitHub lately. I know I'm really, really late to the party, but I've been getting into that for KiCad and looking at it because I finally figured out what the hell is going on with it, and now that I have, I'm kind of into it. So, have you ever
done
Git stuff or
played with Git? A little bit, but so my problem is that I started with Subversion and now I'm using Perforce quite a bit. And so this is another issue where once you've trained your mind one way, it's really hard to switch. Mm-hmm. So I've played with Git, but I can never remember so I guess GitHub is easy because you can just click and download, but know how to push changes to Git or do anything like that.
Okay, so here is my cognitive switch. This is actually what did it for me, and the only reason I think without this I wouldn't be able to do it. And I know that some software weenies are going to be all up in arms. Sorry about calling you weenies, but the only thing that's really made sense to me is the GitHub Windows tool, which actually connects to the server, the GitHub servers, and everything. You know, you create an account and everything, connects to the servers, and then. It shows the linear progression of your changes, like your commits. Mm-hmm. That alone, like the text stuff, I'm sure that I would get it eventually, and I'm sure that I'll probably end up using that eventually as well. But the fact that, I don't know, it was just so, it's so intuitive now, like seeing this tool. And I know there's a lot of people don't like it, but if people are out there listening and they're interested in, revision control in this way, that's what did it for me, because I've been looking at it as I wanted to be able to like make boards and go back to very specific points without having like the standard, I'm on rev one, save folder rev one, copy to folder two, rev two, right? Because I'm terrible at that. I'll end up making, a lot of people are terrible at that. You make weird conventions, you go to 1A, 1B, and it's like, why did I do this? I don't, having all that stuff. So this, I needed a very specific way of referencing save points for the course, and I started looking at this, and this is it, man. Like, having, like, the hashed revision points, it's killer. So I'll be talking more about it, I'm sure, but I'm finally converted. I know it's not like, people have been doing this for a long time, but I finally made the transition as a hardware nerd. So,
does KiCad support Git or anything like that internally in the tool?
No, but it's all plain text, so you can do diffs. And then someone named Robert Spitzenfeld, he does a bunch of videos on YouTube for KiCad. He actually is a Linux user as well, and so he has a bunch of scripts on there. And he actually set up he wrote a script that he just released. He actually didn't release it at all, but he had written it for himself that actually does visual diffs. So he'll take the changes between two revisions or two commits rather, which commits being save points, and then be able to generate Gerbers for each layer. And one will be red, one will be blue, and then they'll overlay, and then you can see where your components have changed. I think he said that you have to have the board outline in there for it to really work well for all layers, so you need to have the board outline in all layers, but, I mean, that's kind of a small change, or it's a small small price to pay, as long as you remember to remove it at the end of your before you send it out. And even if you don't, I mean, the board router will probably get it, so... I haven't played with that yet, but it's very... That's the promise. That could be the killer app for KiCad/GitHub, you know, like that.
And pretty cool. I actually think that's how open source tools will end up beating the proprietary tools, will be that kind of stuff, because the proprietary tools are so bad at integrating features, especially quickly. Mm-hmm. And more power to them. That's awesome. I would love to have that. I'll have to check that out.
Yeah, we talked. Cool. When we were talking to Michael last week, I mean, we were talking about like the softwareification of hardware, and like that is like a very, very visible benefit, right? I mean, like like hardware people are never going to do that, right? I mean, we've struggled with CAD programs from the start, but when you start having people who are comfortable writing scripts, and you get these mashups like that, I mean, that is just some killer stuff.
I actually think, speaking of Michael, I think that's why the HackRF is going to be so successful. So I actually backed that Kickstarter campaign.
Oh, you did? Cool.
And so the reason I think the HackRF is going to be huge and is potentially going to be the most significant SDR since the USRP is going to be because it's aimed primarily at software people, and it's not aimed at hardware people. So you abstract away the hardware, and you said this on the last show. I totally agree with that. And I'm actually really excited to be a part of this. And of course, as a hardware guy, I'm going to be learning. It's going to be a real big learning curve to try to figure out GNU Radio and how to interface with this stuff. But I'm also super interested to see where the community brings this. And I'm super, super excited about the HackRF and everything that Michael's doing.
I think I need to make a cognitive switch too, because I've done this a couple times, right? Like my friend who I used to work with, you know, he was a hardware guy, but he was really into like putting micros on board, like with some analog components, like for real close control, real fast control of stuff. Mm-hmm. And he got a lot of backlash for it, actually, you know, because there was a lot of segmentation between analog and digital and code, obviously, as well. Mm-hmm. And because he was trying to do everything, he got a lot of backlash for it, and included me included, you know, like, why are you bothering with that, right? But it seems like more and more every time that I have these feelings of, you know, oh, you know, you got to keep that stuff separate, that's I'm always in the wrong, you know, and I always end up changing my mind. I need to have like a hard and fast rule. It's like that level of integration and that speed, that having software on like close to the hardware, as close as you can get, really, just like SDR is, right? I mean, SDR is basically taking a physical signal and trying to get it into bits as fast as possible.
That's right.
I see it. Honestly, I was thinking about this with what was it? I saw it as a threat. I've been feeling threatened lately. I think it's just getting older. I know it's really stupid, but I'm sure there's some people out there, you know the feeling. You know, it's just like, oh, that's my job. Why are you doing that, right? And it's like, that is just the wrong feeling, right? I mean, like, talking just as a human being now, like, that's the wrong feeling to have, because that's probably the sign of progress, right? If you feel that, if you're feeling threatened by some kind of change, you know, like thinking like Innovator's Dilemma as well, that is probably the sign of, you need to get off your ass and learn something new. Like, speaking to myself personally, I need to get off my ass and, you know, learn to code, learn GitHub, that kind of thing. When I feel that feeling, I need to recognize that trigger and be like, oh, I should pay attention. I should probably buy a HackRF. Because, you know, you'll just get left behind, right? I mean, like, it happens all the time.
When I graduated college, that was a thing. SDR, I graduated out of an RF heavy program, and SDR was already looming on the horizon at that point in time. And there was definitely, I had multiple conversations with professors and people in the industry about, you know, is RF going away as a career option? because of SDR? Is it going to make all this stuff obsolete? And I actually did graduate research in SDR, and it has taken way longer than I would have expected for this stuff to become commonplace. But it's also actually made it clear to me that it's not really like the RF engineers are becoming obsolete. It's just that their role is sort of changing, and the types of problems that they're having to solve are different. But if you look at the HackRF, there's a ton of RF circuitry in there. I mean, I was poking around in the schematics a couple weeks ago, and there are switches and up converters, down converters, mixers, everywhere. There's a ton of RF stuff
in there. It's still mostly integration, right? It's not like you're doing a ton of discrete stuff, but at the same time, if you get something, if you don't know what you're doing in there, you are going to mess some stuff up. You're going to have some bad signals.
Yeah, although the beauty of it is that I think SDR is going to be fairly forgiving of that, and so you're still going to be able to receive just, maybe not as well, or especially you definitely don't want to be transmitting without having some sense of what you're doing, because the FCC would be very unhappy
spewing crap onto the spectrum.
But
so 20 megahertz is not supposed to be next to 40 megahertz.
So I'm actually curious, and not to harp on about the HackRF and SDR, but I'm curious if sales of spectrum analyzers are going to go up as a result of this, because one of the first things that you're going to want is to be able to look at your signals, and you can either use another HackRF or you're going to actually need a little bit of test equipment. So it's going to be really interesting to see. I'm, like I said, looking forward to checking this out as I think in January when the units start shipping, to see what people do with them. And, you know,
do you have any plans about what you're looking at doing with it?
Of course not.
That's not why you buy it, right?
Total impulse buy. No, I don't know. I actually want to learn more about SDR and how SDR has changed since I was first exposed to it over about 10 years ago, 15 years ago. So I'm interested in learning, and I'm actually interested in applying it to amateur radio, which is, I think, one of the obvious applications. I have a feeling that not long from now, the idea of a radio having a dial that you have to tune is going to
feel it'll be there for the hipsters,
really
old
fashioned.
It'll be like red with an ADC or a digital encoder. And
that stuff's already kind of going away, and I think that this sort of thing is going to be the last nail in the coffin of having a tuned receiver.
Maybe.
Because, I mean, apart from
you'll
the
still
nostalgia,
get the ham buys, right? You'll get the Greg Charvats, like, drooling over the... I mean, the hardware is really nice and the tactile.
It'll become a different thing. It's going to be like guys that are interested in classic cars. You know,
you want
it because you're interested in the experience of having this old thing. And, I mean, I drive a 40-year-old car every day, and there are certain people that are into that stuff, but... for all practical purposes, it is obsolete. Like, there's just a better way of doing that. And I think that for amateur radio in particular, the ability to look at the entire HF spectrum, maybe even in more than one band at once, is going to completely revolutionize ham radio. And it's already starting to happen thanks to the Flex Radio and thanks to L-Craft and a lot of the efforts that are going on around having pan adapters and wide bandwidth receivers. I think that things like the HackRF are going to completely change not only amateur radio, but also I think a lot of other forms of radio. Like, for example, there was that car stereo, like TiVo for FM radio, that was at the Maker Faire Bay Area this year. I can't remember the name of the project, but it listens to everything and records everything. And so you can tune to any station and then move forward and backward in time. Well, not forward in time from the present.
If you
can
stuff,
you can rewind. If you miss the last few innings of a baseball game, you just go back in time and listen to it. So
That's cool.
That kind of stuff, I think, is going to become commonplace. I mean, that's my own theory, because I think it's just so convenient to have that ability to take sort of the temporal nature, like to either get rid of the time domain or the frequency domain in radio and be able to move between those things easily. So I'm excited.
That's great.
Looking forward to it.
And that's like an abundance effect as well, right? I mean, like, at this point, we're kind of inundated with these low-cost radio chips that are, like, that's what's allowing all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And the same thing for microcontrollers and everything else, too, right? It's not like it's a new phenomenon. But, right. I mean, like you said, with being able to like just see the spectrum, right? Like, and I've said this on the show before, when I bought the SDR, I have like a TV dongle, the TV USB dongle, and like it's not like great, but it's not bad either. And but having it, like, these should be absolutely required in every signals class. Like, I know that like a lot of educational institutions are more about the theory and the math first, but you know, you want to talk about context and understanding what the hell you're talking about. Mm-hmm. Like looking at a spectrum and realizing that when you're doing a filter, you're just narrowing in on like this little part that's darker where the signal actually is. Like that is such yeah. a killer like mental shift that like being able to see that is so hard to do when you're just doing math problems. And being able to see that immediately is so beautiful. I can't get enough of that. Having these kind of mental aids that are so cheap and so easily and hackable, and like, you know, people can yeah. take that and just go create and build software around it. So yeah, yep. it's exciting, man.
Yep. I think it's going to spur innovation in classical RF design too, because one of the major weaknesses of software-defined radios is on the transmitting side. And making RF power amplifiers that are agile in frequency is very hard, or at least efficient over a broad range. It's just like making antennas that are efficient over a broad frequency range is hard. This is something that people have been working on for a long time, and it's still not clear what the right answer is, but there are a lot of techniques. And so, yeah, I think along with software-defined radio, there's going to be a lot of interesting opportunities to improvise better antennas, better amplifiers on the transmitting and receiving side, just all the
multi-mode stuff, right? Like multi and MIMO, everything.
Yeah,
the
ability to transmit on multiple frequencies with different modulation formats simultaneously is super interesting.
Yeah,
and that's something
that
SDR
30 years ago, right? I mean, like one person might have been able to.
Well, it's like you could transmit a voice carrier with a data channel alongside it that's giving you, you know, kind of like how a lot of walkie-talkies will transmit a little bit of position information or something. It's like you could do all of that with a single transceiver, just a single chip. It's amazing. Yeah, cool stuff. Cool stuff.
Yeah, that's good. We're in a good time. It's a good time. Good time to be around. Good time to go to the conferences together too.
Yeah, there's actually a digital radio conference coming up in a couple weeks.
Oh yeah, the Tapper, is that right?
Yeah, Tapper is doing a conference in Seattle this year, so obviously that's really close to me. So I'm planning on going down there for at least one of the days, and I think registration is still open. It's down by SeaTac. Cool. So I noticed that Michael Osman is going to be there actually giving a talk, so might be cool to check out. I'll definitely
try
to
get down
there.
You guys should have an amp hour meetup. That's man, that's honestly like my new thing. Like I'm having actually, so I should mention that too. We are having an amp hour and MJ Lorton, Martin Lorton's in Cleveland now too. So we're gonna have a meetup on Thursday of this week, the 12th.
Cool.
So if anyone's in Cleveland, they should definitely sign up for that. But yeah, man, I am all about whenever you're going to conferences, if you look around and you don't see a meetup, just set one up. It's so friggin' easy. And you know what? And like I said before, if people are setting up and they tell them to us, you know, like, and we're not part of the setting up, I'm happy to talk about it on here. It's because nothing. I was talking to Chris, one of the guys that's in the CE program, about it. It's like nothing beats. Like, you know, like I'm so isolated, not so isolated, but I'm pretty isolated throughout the year, right? I mean, like I have some people at work and, you know, there's some people in the area, but Cleveland is not like a technology hub like Seattle or Silicon Valley. And it's like, man, you get to a bar with like 50 people who are interested in the exact same kind of stuff as you are. And there's like good beer and good food and like, and just like time to talk. Like, man, like that makes the introvert melt away.
So actually, one of the things that's, and I totally agree with you, and I think meetups like that are awesome, and I've been to a number of them, usually around the Maker Faire. They're, you know, Jerry always has awesome, super fun, super interesting meetups. One of the things that, so you say Cleveland is not a technology town. One of the things that's interesting is that Redmond and Seattle kind of is, but yet there isn't anything like that, particularly around Microsoft territory. And I kind of am curious about that, kind of culturally, what it is about Microsoft and the kind of people that are in this area. I think Microsoft employs something like 3,000 hardware engineers that are all hardware engineers. And they're all within 5 minutes of where I commute on a daily basis and where I live. And yet, walking around, you would really have no idea.
Yeah. Well, maybe it's because it's so big. They can just stay on campus and get to know one. When I was at Keithley, it was such a big analog group. And it's like, well, why bother going outside? We just talk to each other, right? I mean, like, that. Yeah, and that has its benefit, too.
We're definitely guilty of doing that at my office, too. I mean, we've got our own, we go out for drinks just at the office, and we've got enough people that we can have, pretty interesting technical discussion just among some of the really interesting people that I work with on a daily basis. But there are not 3,000 of us. They're definitely not.
Not yet. You'll get there, man.
Yeah. So I just find that super interesting. So maybe that just means that I need to organize something.
That's what I was going to suggest as well. And I suggest that for any, I mean, like, it's a little, actually, it's interesting. Meetup.com actually is not free. I didn't realize that, but it's like $15 a month. It's like, I guarantee that $15 is going to come back to me in spades in terms of, getting to meet people and making connections.
And you'll be sending annoying follow-up emails to the people that subscribe for years afterwards.
Oh, yeah.
Every meetup organizer has always done to me in the history of meetup.
Yeah, well, it's built into the system,
If you
so
can't
that's why.
Tell, I'm not... Meetup and me don't really get along very well.
No.
But hey...
You're signing up for the wrong groups, man.
Maybe like the Naggers Anonymous was a bad choice.
Yes, that's right.
I say, whatever tool works, but it sounds like a great idea. That sounds super fun. And especially... for someone like you, where there isn't a lot going on in the area, I mean, there are probably lots of people that would love to talk to each other and, socialize about that.
Well,
stuff.
And that's, you see a lot of the groups that are really good at meetups, like a lot of startups are, because, they're smaller to start with. First off, they're looking at connections, but they're smaller to start with. And, you need to get out and want to talk to people. So that's why, and usually, the types that do startups are a little more, what's the right term? Social? I'll go with social. Probably not the term I'd use if I was drinking beer, but social. I think it just really fits that model well. I think it can fit hardware too.
That's why I think the Bay Area is so great for being in hardware, because there are so many people that are movers and shakers or trying to be, and so many startups that in the Bay Area, there's always something going on.
Yeah,
so
right,
I think we just need to help replicate that in other areas. And I think one of the most important things for a meetup to be successful is to not have it be super commercialized or like self-serving. Yeah. And that's why I think the Amp Hour is great, because people are just interested in getting to know each other, and there's this genuine curiosity about what other engineers are doing and what it's like to work in other disciplines, right? And you really get that in the Amp Hour, because people come from all different walks of engineering. That sounds awesome to me.
Well, cool, man. Should we talk about anything else? It's been we talked like that was like a fast. That was a pretty fast hour, even by our standards.
I'm probably going to get emails saying that I talked the whole episode again. So
no,
to those people,
perfect.
I'm sorry. I apologize.
No, this is the right amount of Jeff. We've missed Jeff for too long. It's worked out nicely because we are recording on Sunday night. So Jeff, usually our schedules don't line up, and Dave couldn't make it because he's heading out of town. So. Hopefully next time we can get it so that maybe we can do a holiday Kaiser special. What do you think?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Happy holidays, sir.
It'd be great. I haven't been on the show with Dave in a long time. So yeah. Should do.
Was it just me and you last time? Was that what it was?
I can't remember.
Oh.
I can't remember.
Yeah. Well, you should just get rid of your crazy ass job schedule.
Mondays are hard. Sunday is a great day for recording. And I mean, we're fortunate just because we're kind of close in time zones, right? So we can do this. But
right.
And
Dave plays he's the daycare, so that it's totally understandable. That's the reason he's working on his own. He's got that kind of freedom to
Well, he just needs like a robotic nanny or something like that, right?
Yeah. Or have Sagan on the show.
Open source nanny.
Open source nanny sounds a little weird, but yeah. All right, man. Should we mention anything else? I mean, usual stuff. I think, you know, you guys have seen all this stuff throughout the week. If you haven't seen, the subreddit's there. It's there for the taking. let's see. We've been doing rapid fire news stories at the end sometimes. Hmm. It's New Zealand got rid of software patents. That was cool.
Ooh.
And wow. And also over in that part of the world, they also got Kickstarter now. So now you can have a Kickstarter to not patent something.
Well, it'll be a Kickstarter for a software company.
There you go. Yeah.
Right. Well, more power to those guys. That's awesome.
Yeah, that is awesome. I hope that takes off. I mean, especially coming off the Open Source Hardware Summit. That'd be cool. Especially for software. What a mess. All right. People could check out the subreddit. Sorry we didn't talk about everything here, but we'll get to it in 2 weeks. Next week, we will have the Upvoter guys on, which will be interesting. Speaking of CAD tools and,
yeah.
Because they do have a compelling offering. I've disparaged them a little in the past from the online only, but they'll definitely get that question as well. And we'll, hear about the... What they see going forward, and for making hardware and they're very big in open hardware as well. George Hahn is one of their interns, was at the summit, and I was talking to him about it a little bit, and I did that hangout with them for their builds. They've been doing like builds online using the tool and the collaborative tools, which are definitely a powerful part of their platform. So we'll see how that goes. But we'll have questions up too, so people can ask questions for next week.
Sounds cool.
All right, man. Well, don't be a stranger.
I'll try not to be.
All right. Come back and see us soon.
Well, thanks for having me on the show. It's always a lot of fun. And maybe with Dave, we'll have like the good old days of
your days.
Back in 2010 when we started.
2010, yeah.
First time you had me on was probably 2010.
Yeah, 2010.
Time flies. But this was a lot of fun. Thanks.
Cool, man. Well, we'll see you next time.
All right. Cheers.
Bye. Yes, sir. You are correct, sir.